Transit Voices with Ben Whitaker.
Welcome to Transit Voices. This month, we're going beyond the headlines with Carlos Padro from Colombia, who had been a champion cyclist that then became a mobility and urban transport policy advisor. What I love in this month's edition is we're getting the real story behind some of the projects like Bogota's BRT bike parks, the real story behind Enrique de Penaloza's quotation on real developed cities having the bankers on the bus, and a few of the really gnarly problems about safety getting people onto public transport in more dangerous areas. Without further ado, let's hear more from Carlos.
Now, let's get talking.
So, welcome to Transit Voices. Carlos Padro, it's fantastic to have you here. We got involved in a few conversations on LinkedIn, and I just think you've got a wealth of experience in some very interesting active mobility and mobility projects in your home country in Colombia, in Bogota, that I'd love to speak about. But we'd also love to hear just a little bit more from you about how you got into mobility in the first place.
I'm actually a psychologist. That was my major in university. And then towards the end, I was working in my internship as an industrial psychologist in an NGO who was promoting bicycle use. So I had been racing in mountain biking. I was actually a downhill champion in Colombia in the 90s. So this whole thing around working in an NGO that was promoting cycling as a mode of transport was a good fit. But after a while, I sort of said, this does make a lot of sense, not so much as a psychologist, but rather as somebody who's working on policy. And I had the opportunity to continue working on that. I actually went to Bangkok, where I was coordinating a project for Asia. The title is super pompous. It was a coordinator for the Sustainable Urban Transport Project in Asia. And then I did it for Latin America. Even more pompous because I was the one for Asia and Latin America. And that was with GIZ and the UN. And then after a while, I was at the London School of Economics studying urbanism because I was fed up with people saying, how come you're a psychologist and you're working in transport policy? So I said, okay, something that can help me in explaining quicker. And then I did my own NGO, which is called Despacio, here in Bogota, on transportation policy and a few more things, sort of in the slow transport or slow philosophy, let's say. I led that for almost 10 years. I was tired, literally like physically tired, because it was like, you know, these babies that you have as an organization. And then I started working. I went to the US to work in the New Urban Mobility Alliance. Then I came back around the pandemic. And since then, I've been working on several things with several organizations, mostly on urban transport policy, mostly advising governments. And more recently, I'm building bicycles as a volunteer, which is taking too much of my time, but I'm still working on those things. So yeah.
That's quite a journey into it, but interesting that you came from professional or competitive cycling into urbanism. That's a route I've not heard before from any of our other guests. It's great to hear you go from working in the evangelist groups and semi-advisory to recognizing that it's in the politics that really big levers can be thrown and changed. Mm. One of the things that always has frustrated me coming from the sort of IT and payment side that then got into public transit through transit ticketing was always how the prestige politically around any project was almost exactly connected to the budget. So project had the biggest budget, therefore had the most prestige, we'd be most defended. And also people think they can build their careers on it. This keeps coming back to us in active mobility and in active transport. We see in the United Kingdom right now, they are putting a new bit of road in. It's 2 miles of road. And the budget to put this 2 miles of new road in is bigger than the total national budget for bicycling and active mobility. And how is it that something where we've seen such a positive impact in the cities post-COVID from everybody putting more bicycles in, and you know, you and Bogota, we have seen such an elegant link between public transit and cycling be kind of built in from the get-go. How have you managed to keep bicycling so important and not just be drowned out by the prestige of money?
So it's a good thing that I'm a psychologist, because this is the kind of thing that I try to understand as a psychologist rather as a policy person. Why do people feel that the larger projects are better? Why do politicians feel that this is the best way to go? And why do citizens understand this as a good investment? So I think what happens is there's this innate wonder towards large things, like large, physically large. those will be expensive. And for that reason is why I think that both policymakers and citizens say, well, look, they've just built this huge thing. That must be very good because it's so monumental. Like, it's sort of the monumentality of things. And then it's sort of the thing, how is that represented in investments in transportation? And there's a lot of even weird examples out there about this. So you're right that many times we see the large investments in roads because they're incredibly expensive. And then I do have an example that I'd like to give to you towards the end around that. And that is pretty clear to people in transportation. But then people who have the voice in the media and in policy and then even Congress or whatever decision-making body at the national or local level or council, they are people who either are riding a car all day or most of the time, or would like to ride a car, drive a car, own a car. So when they are in that mindset, then they say, well, I need my space for this thing, which is incredibly inefficient, but this is what society has told me is success. So in the end, they're riding a car and they're hoping that their car can be ridden as it is shown in the media. And they try to get all policy around that. So it's sort of this horrible combination of things where the monumental stuff is seen as very positive and the very inefficient vehicle, everybody has been convinced, or many people have been convinced, that that is the way to go. So it's pretty difficult to get people out of that, right?
So that exactly that scenario that you just described of the politician riding in the car and feeling that that is the mark of success. Wasn't it one of the previous mayors of Bogota? I probably can't pronounce it. Enrique de Pedrosa? Yeah. Who said the measure of when you're a truly developed international business city is not when everybody has a car. It's when the bankers are on the public transit. Or what's to that effect? It's that instead of thinking that aspiration is everybody has a car, you go and you travel in Paris and London and Tokyo, and you find that it's the top level senior management who are riding around on the bus and the subway. And that's a truly developed city rather than sitting in a beautiful armored limousine for 2 hours each way, getting in and out of Mexico City. Really, he built such and invested in such a very sort of complete, to me. I mean, when I visited Bogota a few years back, it struck me not only how much had been done in terms of the bus rapid transit system, the BRT, it also the symbolism, and as you were saying, the kind of monumentalism of these wonderful BRT routes run straight down the middle of the main freeways, so that everybody who's stuck in a log jam of slow cars can see all of the BRT, the bus rapid transit, hammering past them, these wonderful articulated buses, which are just going past them. But then it isn't just the monumentalism. One of the things that I think we spoke about briefly on LinkedIn was the fact that these main BRT ingress points not only were designed around feeder buses being able to bring people in from the surrounding area that didn't have BRT and then getting on the fast BRT and getting in and out of town, they also had very well set up and organized bicycle parks. I was just struck by how it wasn't just the monumentalism of the BRT, which was very symbolically in everybody's face, but it was how elegantly it had been put in with the bikes, and underneath the BRT, it's got bike lanes as well, just so you can get, you know, that extra distance to it. And did you see any of the lobbying and the public outreach that went around that as it was being constructed and invested in?
One thing just that you said about Peñalosa talking about developing countries, one where rich people take the public transport, that was an anecdote, actually. He was in some dinner, there was a Nobel laureate, and then I think it was in New York or Washington or somewhere. And when he left the dinner, he was going to take the metro. And then he met again with the Nobel laureate going to take the metro. And he was like, oh, this is super interesting. And that's where he came with his very incredibly famous phrase, which I find sort of more illuminating how he came about that. To your whole point around BRT integration and the safety or the security in the system. That is a really interesting story, and I think it has to be more nuanced, of course. This place that you meant is the America's portal, right? It is one of the endpoints of the BRT, which is really in the outskirts of the city, and this was part of the phase two of the system. So in phase one, which went to Ochenta, Caracas Avenue, not the city, they even had signs in the portal saying, we do not respond for your bicycle here. Essentially, they were saying bicycles are unwelcome, right? And like, we have a picture of that. Like, everybody shows that picture, like, please do not leave your bicycle here. because people found that it was very convenient for them to arrive at this terminal station by bicycle, but there was nowhere to park. So, and when you look at the history of public transport, it happens a lot. They're like, oh, what? Bicycles have nothing to do here. They're competition. There was somebody somewhere in some meeting, which I haven't been able to know exactly how it went, but they actually changed their minds in phase two in that portal in America. They started there because they said it was an incredibly pragmatic issue. They said, well, feeder systems are expensive because they take, like, the feeder does not have did not have back then an additional cost to the fare of the user, but they had to pay it. And it was taking up something like 30 or 40% of the fare. So it was incredibly expensive to have feeder buses all the time for everyone. So they said, well, look, this depot is huge. We have this space, which we haven't sort of found use for it. Let's put 785 spaces for bicycles here. And they're hooks, right? Which is incredibly space efficient, not very user-friendly. So they said, well, let's have this and let's see what happens. And of course, it was an incredible success, like immediately. Like people were like, this is perfect. We can get on our bikes because it was also free. It's always been free. You can always park your bike for free in Transmilenio stations where there are bicycle parking spaces. And ever since Americas, they started to do this like progressively. And it's pretty cool. Like if you look at the evolution, and I recommend people read the bicycle account, which is a document that we wrote in 2015, looking at all these things, that we even sort of looked at the evolution of the bicycle parking. But it was really interesting to see how the system opened up first to having bicycles arrive at these terminal stations. The most elaborate system is the one that you saw in Americas. The others are sort of not so elaborate, but this one is beautiful. You have a picture of you, a picture of the bicycle. The bicycle has a barcode, which you beep as well. So it's exactly your bike, which is shown as you enter and as you leave. And there's something like 9,000 spaces of bicycles parking throughout the city. So that's incredibly impressive. And it's probably the second city that has BRT of the largest amount of bicycle parking. The largest in the world is Guangzhou, because they have bike parking in every station throughout the system. So it's unbeatable. One thing that I think I need to do is sort of, there is this romanticized version of Bogota. And we really have to be sincere. And sort of many people don't like me when I'm sort of in international settings saying, well, yeah, there's a lot of bicycles, but like there's a lot of theft, not Netherlands theft, right? Like when you talk to people in the Netherlands, they say, well, there's 16 million people, 70 million bicycles, because there's a million bicycles stolen every year. But they're taken from them in a parking space, in the street or whatever. Like here you have theft. Like, so 30% of theft in our city is because people are being mugged. Like there's some weapon involved. Another 30% is because they're conned. Like somebody says, oh, what a nice bike. And then they talk to them, like very Latin American thing. Like you're talking to people, they're becoming your friends. And then all of a sudden they take your bike. Like they literally ask you for the bike. They say, can I take your bike for a ride? And you're like, yeah, it's okay. Like, and they take it from you. So that's 30%. And the other 30% is something around leaving it unlocked, like the Amsterdam type of theft.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of theft. My hypothesis is that we do not have more than 10% bicycle use because of safety concerns and a few other things. But we also ask people, like, what are your concerns? And it's safety, road safety, security, or bicycle being stolen, them being mugged. And then all the other stuff, like cars running them over, or sort of interaction with other vehicles. So I think we do have a beautiful, if you went to Americas, you saw that, like it's thousands of people a minute going through there.
That's worldwide, is the interaction with other road users, especially the sense of car-centric design and car driver entitlement can be very difficult to walk back in a city, even though, as we saw in Paris, when they closed off lanes to, you know, increase bicycle capacity while people were being told to avoid the buses and the metros, they've kept a lot of that space back because so rapidly people given safe spaces to cycle would start cycling. But the theft, I mean, while I was there, it was really about fare collection that I was there, and we encountered numbers in some areas up to 40% shrinkage or loss of revenue, either through people avoiding paying fares or stealing from within the system. So automated fare collection or fare collection that removes cash from the system was preferable with Transmilenio with a BRT. They have to park the buses so close to the sliding sort of plexiglass doors because people will run across the freeway, jump between the bus and the platform and try and squeeze up between the bus and the platform to get into the doors, you know, leap full-size turnstiles. It's definitely a challenging environment to make public transit crime-free. The feeling of safety on board the BRT for Transmilenio is very high, even though you're driving around areas which have reasonably high crime rates.
BRT is the safest way to move in Bogota, like literally the safest in terms of road safety. When you look at the stats, nobody has died in a Transmilenio bus, even if it has crashed. The worst way to travel in Bogota is walking, sadly, going by motorbike, then riding a bicycle. But the huge proportion is walking or riding a motorbike. So public transport is incredibly safe in terms of road safety. Getting to the bus is not so safe. So that's sort of sad. And then there's this whole issue that I think is a beautiful question conceptually. Practically, it's very difficult, but conceptually, it's beautiful to ask, should I charge for transit? And there's a lot of sort of debate, like those who have made free transit or fare free transit, some have not had the results they expected. Some were thinking about other results and got another kind of thing. It was very expensive. It did not increase ridership. Like all these things, it's a huge question.
Well, this is almost related to a follow-on question I wanted to ask, related more to Medellin rather than Transmilenio, where they were putting, I think, the cable cars and a few other mass transit into areas that were traditionally incredibly dangerous, physically dangerous, very high levels of mugging, violent mugging, kidnapping. And the idea of putting a brand new, clean, public resource of vehicles where there was a real risk that you would end up with gangs sitting and riding around on the buses, making it their space. And so from what I've understood, the public outreach and the positioning of this as a safe public resource and trying to make sure that it wasn't becoming a ride around for gangs and a place that you would be more in danger. And not only having to put the security in, but trying to get the public expectation right. And this is all exactly, it's very related to free fares because some of the free fares experiments going on in the United States have found that when you make the public transit free and unmetered, that you get a reduction of choice riders, you get a reduction of riders who are very safety conscious, and you get an increase of social problems moving onto public transit. And the even if you've heavily discounted public transit, especially for disadvantaged riders or low-income riders, there isn't quite the same transfer of social problems into the vehicle. And I just wonder, now that we're quite a number of years on from the launch of Medellin's kind of newly invested public transit, can you characterize, I think you were just about to get there, not only the fare-free, or rather having fares and some sort of control and metering of how much time you're spending on public transit, but how you maintain a situation where public transit is safer than everywhere else?
The Medellin case is interesting in that they have a metro company that is essentially operating everything. And the metro company has the highest rating in any public agency in the city, which is unheard of in the world. Like the transit agency always gets the heat, but they have an impeccable image. It's incredible. And they have this thing called the pride of the metro. So all of that pride carries on with the system. And when they did the cable cars, of course, there was a horrible question of what if a gang leader gets onto each of the cabins, or the gang people get into each of the cabins. And when you get off the cabin, you're like mugged completely, which is a huge sort of concern of many people. But that pride has been a staple of Medellin, I think, since, let's say, the transformation in many ways, significant reduction in incredible violence, assassination, like the drug wars and all this. So part of that has been this creation of a pride in the city, in the system, which has miraculously gone all the way into these very dangerous neighborhoods. But the thing is, when these neighborhoods are given such high quality service, they understand that they will have to care for it. And this is part of the magic of what Medellin has done. And if you go back to Bogota, it is part of the very, very, this incredibly difficult scenario where transit has been heavily politicized. So there is, it is exactly the opposite of Medellin. People hate transit. They hate the SITP, which is the broader integrated system of Transmilenio. And more like the more so TransMilenio. They really, really hate TransMilenio. And I say they because it's a majority of people just say TransMilenio is the worst because it's the worst. So then let's not take care of it. And this is horrible. And sometimes it's they say it's because we don't have a metro, we should have a metro. And I don't find any logic in that. But of course, these things are not logical. It's sort of, it was politicized and it kept being politicized, so then people don't care. So we have this downward spiral where fare evasion is because people don't care, don't value, and don't take pride in the system. There's also even smaller things like the design of the system. If you want to get to Transmilenio here next to this place where I am, or next to other places where I'm working, you have to go over an overpass. And the distance you have to travel to get to the bus is incredibly long. And when you see some of the people who are evading the fare, crossing these large avenues, they prefer to risk their life than their time. Because they say, well, physically I'm able to jump and to run, and they will get into the bus because they don't care. And because they say, well, I can just get in. And my proof of that being part of it is that they also get off the bus that way. Like I always tell people, look at the station for a while and you will start seeing how people get on the bus. Yes, as we know, 15% of fare evasion overall is present in the system, but they also get off the bus in that incredibly risky way. And why would they do that? It's just because they say, well, I'm too lazy to go up and down this long overpass. I'll just cross here because it's fine. I won't die. Because it's a very weird thing where you have the combination of factors. So yesterday there was this, there's a big discussion in Bogota around the new Transmilenio stations, because the first reaction of many of us was like, this was designed by the prison system. Because it's incredibly closed down, like full of thorns. And like it's incredible to get, it's impossible to get in, but also to get out. Because they say, well, there's no other way of reducing evasion. And some people were saying, well, you can put whatever you want to enter the station, but people are getting in through the doors of the bus, the ones that you said. So it's an incredible difficult topic. I can't find a way out of it. And every time I find a way out, it's a trap. And I don't think it's just saying, well, let's bring the Medellin people of great pride. It's a very, very profound change that should start by politicians saying, we believe in the system. Otherwise, I don't see an improvement to that.
It is that different cultural relationship with shared infrastructure, and whether or not you see it as something you're proud of and you want to see get better, or it's where you see yourself almost an enemy of that piece of state infrastructure and you feel justified in shortchanging the public transit or breaking it or doing something else. We see some pieces of fare collection equipment coming from China, which have switches and wires that you can see and get access to. And in China, they don't get vandalized because it's more seen as shared community infrastructure, and it would be shameful to tear that up. Whereas if you were to put that in Sweden, it would be destroyed by school children who are bored in the first morning. Just the relationship with state infrastructure, as you say, can be entity specific. One of the other topics that you brought up recently was around the transition from some people from active travel and active transport like bicycles back to gas guzzling motorbikes. You were saying, I think on one of your articles, how for access to jobs, people are wanting to say that they now have a motorbike. And if they can step up to a motorbike and have the perceived extra mobility, then they can pick up more jobs in areas that maybe are not so well served by direct public transit. I think I referred back to what I'd seen in Shanghai, where they had been trying to combat the smokes and the sulfur that were coming from this giant fleet of mopeds, all inefficiently burning fuel and making smoke everywhere. And they changed the licensing and pricing for bringing a gasoline moped into the city. And as a result, almost all of those gasoline mopeds got cheaply retrofitted into electric. I saw bicycle rickshaws, bicycle vans that had been converted with little batteries, all of the little mopeds with all of their back wheels changed off. And they even a really rusty moped, it was cheap enough for them to switch it up. This change occurred very rapidly. And I'm looking at it, you know, I always used to say when I went to Paris, if I could go back in time and uninvent anything, it would be the moped because of the dreadful noise and smoke for such a small amount of mobility. But they have done it. They have uninvented the petrol moped. And I just wonder, why have we not seen that model replicated in other towns which are plagued by mopeds? And Is that the sort of thing that might be an answer to stop people migrating from bicycles to gas motorbikes? I mean, would that work in Bogota?
This is actually the main question that we asked in the UNEP study that was just published a couple of weeks ago. This on 2 and 3 wheelers and electric 2 and 3 wheelers in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So I was in charge of the Latin America side. There we were trying to say, well, why is it that you have a much better vehicle than the electric 2 and 3 wheeler, but it doesn't take up so quickly? In Africa, it has to an extent. In Asia, it has, like, they produce everything and they have much more stringent regulation. But in Latin America, motorbikes and internal combustion engine motorbikes have had a lot of success commercially. They're incredibly cheap and they're incredibly convenient. And also they are, like I always say, it's like having an additional title in your CV. If you have a motorbike, you will be able to get a job. Of course, you get more access to the places where you could get a job, but you also, in many cases, people do not have any other qualifications that will make them desirable for a certain job. So then mostly delivery jobs, they have to have a motorbike. And those jobs need to be riding 100 kilometers a day. The electric motorbike does not have that autonomy. Or if it has it, you have to then charge it for 6 hours or something. So it's incredibly inconvenient to them to switch.
Yeah, delivery jobs need a higher range than the cheap e-conversions will give you. So that's relevant for those delivery jobs rather than the family runaround to get you in and out of town and shop and everything else.
Exactly. And anyway, there is the range anxiety, right? Even in cars and even when you have good charging infrastructure or swapping infrastructure in this case, people do have range anxiety. And then they'll say, if you rationally like go through it with them, like how many kilometers do you ride a day? For example, for e-bike owners or potential owners, they say, well, I go from here to here. And you're like, well, that's 6 kilometers. So you have at most, let's say 15 kilometers or 10 miles a day. If your e-bike will give you 3 times that, and why are you worried? And they're like, well, I don't know. I'm just worried that I'll be stuck with an e-bike without any battery left. So I think the autonomy, the range anxiety is a part of it. There's a lot of issues around regulation, especially here in Colombia and in Bogota, well, both because it's a national level thing, where it ends up being incredibly expensive to have an electric motorcycle or an electric bicycle. And it is unclear with regards to where they can travel or where they can circulate. Is it on roads? Is it on bikeways? Is it on neither? And police don't have it very clear. So the traffic police will stop somebody and say, where's your license plate? Where's your insurance? Where's your traffic? Your driver's license? And people are like, well, this is an e-bike. And then the traffic police hasn't read Resolution 160 of 2017, which makes it pretty clear. So they're like, well, I don't care. This is a motorbike. And so that's on one side, on the e-bike side. When you have a completely legal e-bike, you will have all these range anxiety issues. You will have theft concerns. And then the traffic police will stop you. So they're like, well, forget it. I'll just get a motorbike, right? And then on the other side, when you have an electric motorbike, the shop will tell you, don't worry, this is a bicycle. Go on the bikeway. It's fine. And the traffic police will say, well, stop. This is purely a motorbike. Like, it's clear. And they're like, well, what do you mean? The shop told me it's not. So I went to talk to the shops, right? And I went and said, as a potential customer, is this legal to ride in the bikeway? And they were like, yes. And I'm like, are you sure? They said, yeah, it's not a problem. Do I need a license plate? No, you don't need it. And I really asked in several places and they were like, no, this is as a bicycle. It's fine. And it wasn't true. So you have this mix of problems where the shop isn't giving you the entire truth because they don't know it, where the traffic police are stopping people and giving them fines for whatever, and where users are with all these concerns, and when they've been stopped twice, they're like, well, I want to sell this thing. So the market isn't there. And then to make things worse, the factories or the distributors of the internal combustion engine motorbikes are the same who import and distribute the electric motorbikes. And the profit margin in the ICE is much, much higher or larger than the profit margin in the electric ones. So there's no incentive in the industry.
That's a shame. I mean, aspects of that are teething issues of just increasing regulatory and enforcement knowledge around a new technology. But we do have very different standards that we set for anything new compared to something old. We're seeing in many of the cities in the United Kingdom, a huge concern and confusion around e-scooters, the little flat ones that you step on, like a kid's scooter rather than like a moped scooter. And the weird thing is that the huge outcry is about the imagined danger to pedestrians from these units, and also the danger to riders to ride on them in the roads. The regulators have managed to persuade many of the e-scooter hire companies to put geofence speed limiters, very fine-grained geofence speed limiters, to change the speed limit at the top of these, depending on whether they're going across a pedestrian plaza or they're going over a road area, etc., because of this perceived threat. And we're just not getting the same thing for cars. It's very strange that we have almost a blindness to the things which have been accepted in our society for years and years, and yet we apply very, very much higher standards to the new things that are coming in.
All those who were there since 100 years of cars get a free pass, mostly because the city was designed as a machine and they are part of that machine, so the machine should work. And why am I asking questions around how this machine, part of a large machine, which is a city, needs to be regulated, right? So that's super weird. It's sort of a huge blind spot. When I was in the New Urban Mobility Alliance, I was there because we wanted to answer all these questions. And how are these new entrants going to be regulated? What should we learn from before? And how should we start regulating everything again? Not the new ones, but rather everything again. How should we start finding these standards? And then I even created this nice sort of tool that I don't think you can find it, but it's called the periodic table of mobility, where you could put the characteristics of your vehicle and it tells you, okay, this should be allowed here, here, here. The driver should have a driver's license. You should have an insurance. Like all these conditions based on the vehicle characteristics, not on the history or whatever. But it is incredible how the lengths the governments have gone to regulate these tiny scooters because they say they're unsafe. And you're like, unsafe to whom and because of what? And who would be generating the lack of safety? It is a larger, faster vehicle. So let's do everything around them. So there's always these pictures like the scooter falling on the sidewalk and then the car parking on the sidewalk, which is worse. What are our moral standards in the end?
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And I in this also, the perceived human right of driving, that it becomes very difficult to permanently remove somebody's driving license, even after repeated illegal and dangerous acts or repeated murder with a vehicle. If I ever was in high office, I certainly would look to change the existing framework for removal of driver's licenses when people have a multiple history of not following the rules, small or large. Before we run out of time, I'd love to get your pick for your idea or technology, which is your worst boondoggle and waste of space that you think we're all spending a bit too much time focusing on at the moment.
As a category, I would say underpasses or overpasses for cars. I think that is a large category. I think is essentially useless inside a city. But there is a specific example of that in Bogota, which is the underpass of the 94th and NQS. It is in the middle of the highest income area of the city. It is this massive interchange underground, which was built for several years and it's now running. It was estimated at $10 million, the cost, and it ended up costing $40 million. So it was a 300% cost overrun of the project.
Can I just verify, is this an underpass to take cars under that bit of the city or to take pedestrians under the road?
No.
Just to take cars. This is this expensive project I was talking in the UK. This is a 2 mile underpass for cars to go past Stonehenge. And it costs more than all of the bicycle infrastructure in the whole United Kingdom. So as somebody was saying.
So as a category, I think that wins because it doesn't really solve. So this was expected to solve a problem of congestion, which it has not.
No, it's induced demand. It's just going to make more cars.
Yeah, and people say, well, that's theory. But you're like, well, look, it's here, it's there.
Yeah, and Paris have proved that it can induce demand goes both ways. If you add roads, you get more cars. Mm-hmm. If you remove roads, cars evaporate. And people find other ways that are more sensible. And it's not that you displace the cars. They just disappear. Yeah. And people who are half-half between using public transit and car go to public transit. People who are half-half on going on a bicycle go to bicycle. Yeah. And you move that line for more people when you take out parking and take out cars. So yeah, I fully agree. Boondoggle is massive car projects, especially in a city, to put a freeway underground or over the top. Yep, I absolutely love it. Yep, total boondoggle. What about the underdog? What should we move that money and attention to?
Cargo bikes.
Cargo bikes. Oh, I love cargo bikes. Cargo bikes for individuals or cargo bikes also as sort of shareables or any cargo bike?
I think whichever form of cargo bike. So there is a nice history here in Bogota, again, because I've sort of known much more Bogota. But in the 80s, a pastry factory here that's called Ramo, the owner needed to make a decision. And then they were like, okay, we need to have a fleet to distribute everything. And the fleet cost X. The assumption was it was trucks. But we also need to fix our warehouses. It's a significant cost. And then I don't know how he decided that it would be tricycles. And since the 1980s, most of their distribution has been in these tricycles. And it was pastry, so they're very light, so the volume is pretty large. So it's a perfect thing to move. So Bogota has a history of this from very early on, of a serious understanding of how cargo bikes can be used. And actually, this is one of the stories that I want to tell, which I haven't, but it is very well documented in a document from the 80s from the Swedish corporation. I think they have been undervalued. And every time that somebody does a study estimating the comparison of emissions, efficiency, time spent, congestion, like everything, cargo bikes always win for essentially any purpose. We need to make them more affordable, but like chains like Decathlon are starting to come up with very cheap cargo bikes. And we need to make it much clearer to everybody. They do have a role. We should start replacing many of the trucks that are inside the city for cargo bikes and then having places where you can bring the bulk of the cargo and then the cargo bikes will take them wherever in a more permeable fashion. And you'll solve a lot of things of congestion, of emissions, even efficiency of the city will be. So I would choose that as the underdog that we need to
love it. More. Absolutely love it. That gets my full-throated support as well. I think hand in hand, those two things, stop packing in more roads and start filling them full of cargo bikes instead. And that will reduce so many inefficient van journeys around the cities. I think that's a great pairing as well. Before you go, is there anybody else you think we should get on the show to get a different view and a different take with some ideas around mobility?
I love Paul Barter. He's in Singapore, and he's been working on one of the most difficult topics and unpopular topics, which is parking policy. And of course, there is the rock star of parking, Donald Chup.
Yeah.
But Paul Barter has this experience in developing countries, which is so incredibly useful because it is much more difficult, right? And he's been doing research on this for decades.
I'll reach out to Paul. I think I stand a better chance of getting him to come and have a chat than Mr. Shoup. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show this month. That's been really great to hear more of the real detail beyond the headlines of some of the moves in Bogota and some of the issues around mixed mobility in your hometown. I hope it's been useful to you and hope to speak to you in person soon.
Thanks a lot, Ben. This was great and happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much to Carlos for coming to speak to us this month. I learned so much about all of the real stories behind the headlines on Bogota, on their bike transformation. Also on the Enrique de Penaloza quotation, which I've always paraphrased but never known the truth behind it. Certainly the political leadership required to change how people think about transit and behave with transit is an ongoing challenge. Not everybody can have the reputation of Medellin. And I fully agree with him that car tunnels and car infrastructure is taking far too much money when we could just be encouraging people onto cargo bikes. Do subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes and tune in next month for more on Transit Voices.
You've listened to Transit Voices, the podcast by transit nerds for transit nerds. Don't forget to subscribe to Transit Voices to keep up with the latest editions on your favorite podcast platform.